I went to high school in Budapest, Hungary, in the communist days, and I discovered computers very early. And this was at a time, this was in 1964, 1965, when computers weren't really known by the public in general. And even I, who was a kid interested in science, I had no idea of what computers that were for and how they worked, especially. And I was really frustrated by this. With all other machines, it was so easy to see how they work, you know, a crane or a machine tool. But with a computer, it's just a box and it does these mysterious things. So I spent a lot of energy in learning about it, and surprisingly enough, I learned how they worked and learned the secrets and learned to program them. And I insinuated myself into a group of computer engineers that accepted me as a free helper and providing programming services. So that's what I was doing in high school. Hungary was a relatively poor country, and it lived on hand-me-downs, for example, from the Soviet state. So we had a computer that was obsolete even by Soviet standards, and the Soviet standards were, of course, quite ways behind the West. So probably in my age group, I must be one of the few people who had experience with the so-called first-generation computers. The Ural, which was a first-generation machine, in terms of size, was giant relative to a personal computer, but in terms of its performance, it was very similar. To give you an example, to add two numbers together took about 100 microseconds on both machines. And 100 microseconds means that it's 10,000, you can repeat it 10,000 times a second. So 10,000 additions a second. Since then, that number has increased tremendously. But just in the beginning of the personal computer revolution, we were back to those small figures. Also, the memory capacity was pretty weak. We are talking about the order of 10 to 12 kilobytes. A machine looked very much like computers looked in 1950s science fiction movies. So when people are talking about flashing lights, they really are describing the real first-generation computers. The reason that those lights were flashing is because every bit of memory in the processor, at least, was represented, or implemented rather, by a vacuum tube. And next to the vacuum tube, it was very easy to include a little lamp that showed the state of that particular unit. For example, if it's a flip-flop, the 1 or a 0. And of course, this state changed continuously as the computer worked, and in a rather random fashion, as you might imagine. Star Trek, in the early Star Trek episodes, we see all those flashing lights on the console, and those are all copies from the earliest computers. But the very interesting thing about them is that the performance that you could obtain with these computers was about the same as much later the performance of an Apple II was with its microprocessor. People do not realize that the first personal computers, for example, the Apple II, that was a step back in terms of computer performance. It was a step up in availability, and of course the price was incredible. But in terms of performance, it's a step back. Well, the first program that I ever wrote was creating a magic square. And I still remember that program and its details. And remember the terrible headache that I got by the end of the day when I finally debugged it and it all worked. I wrote a compiler for a computer language, which was a little bit like Fortran, one of the very early computer languages. And that really made me popular among the employees at that particular installation, because there was no high-level language for this particular machine until then. In a communist society, computers didn't have that much role. You know, for example, you couldn't do payroll on them or practical things like that. I think that their idea was that they would optimize the delivery of concrete or coal from the producers to the consumers. Of course, it would have been much easier to just let the price float and let the price allocate the concrete, but that would have been politically not correct. At that time, the distinction between hardware and software wasn't that clear, at least in terms of the education. People who did programming typically had electrical engineering education, and my first mentors were all electrical engineers. But I very quickly realized that I knew very little about hardware, and it didn't seem that interesting anyway, and it's not as changeable as software is. So this ability to change things and improve things, that was amazing. And I was just enamored by the sheer power of being able to write instructions that is followed by a huge machine. And by huge, I mean physically huge. In terms of performance, they were really pathetic. In the early 1970s, to have a personal computer, to give a person his or her own computer, that was really a heretic thought and almost unthinkable. And to overcome just the revulsion to that thought, one of the early pioneers, Alan Kay, said that we should think of computers like Kleenex. We should use it and then throw it away. Of course, we never do that, but he came up with that metaphor to stress the point that that it's okay to think of computers as other than something that is very expensive and very very precious. To make a long story short, computers gave me the ability to leave Hungary. I was invited by a Danish computer firm, Regnet Centralen. It was really in the forefront of computer language development. They developed Algol, that was one of the first so-called modern high-level languages. And I spent a year there and kind of refined my computer skills, still not having gone to school. And then I was admitted to University of California at Berkeley. Went to Berkeley. I met a lot of professors there, computer science professors. They started a company called Berkeley Computer Corporation, which went bankrupt. And the ruins of BCC were picked up by Xerox, in part to found this new research center called the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, which then become really the center of research into this new idea of personal computing and graphical user interfaces. Xerox PARC started in 1970, just as a research establishment associated with Xerox, but people there were free to pursue interesting projects, very much like, I think, Bell Labs must have been one of the prototypes that Xerox was trying to emulate. And it's almost by accident that it has become a center of computer science research, mostly because of the personality of Bob Taylor, who was hired as the director of one of the laboratories at PARC. And Bob Taylor worked for ARPA, for the Government Advanced Projects Research Agency, that's today called DARPA. He's also famous for having written the first check for the ARPANET that has later become the Internet. So Bob Taylor really participated in a very basic way of the two greatest revolutions of the 20th century, the personal computer revolution and the Internet revolution. Bob, he had many contacts. He was really a people collector. He managed to collect the best and the brightest from all over the country. People like Bob Metcalf, who did Ethernet and founded 3Com, people who later found Adobe, they were PARC alumni, and many other companies, including Apple, benefited from the people who got their experience and did their basic research at Xerox PARC. My project at PARC was, among other things, Bravo, which was the first WYSIWYG text editor. And Bravo was enabled by the first personal computer called Alto. And Alto, you can go to the Smithsonian and see it in a museum. It looks quite modern, except for the processor, which is still too big by modern standards, but it fit comfortably under the table. In fact, we had to give names to our computers, and one of my colleagues' computer was called Gazanda. Ask him why. Oh, because it goes under the desk. It didn't do anything to the marketplace since it ran on Alto, and Alto wasn't marketed ever. There were a limited market entry. Interesting enough, in the U.S. government, the chairman of Xerox, C. Peter McCullough, had some political contacts in Washington and arranged for Altos to be installed at the executive office of the president, in the Congress, and in the Supreme Court building. So we had these personal computers, and including the laser printer, which was probably the more important part of the duo. They were using it in real applications. Of course, the cost was very prohibitive, both to manufacture it and customers wouldn't be able to afford it. It was a research prototype. The purpose was to develop the software more than the hardware. Bravo was an example of a graphical user interface, but Alto itself had many other applications written for it, and these applications demonstrated the manifold uses of the components of the graphical user interface. And these components are the bitmap display, a display where every bit can be individually changed, which was a tremendous breakthrough. Again, it's so natural today, but at that time, just to turn the screen into bits and use memory for the display, that was a very exciting idea. Once you do that, you realize that you are no longer limited to any given way of expression, but you can express yourself by pictures, by graphics, by windows, and I'm talking about the windows that are visible on the screen. Connected with the idea of a bitmap display, we also needed a pointing device, something that you can use to designate things that are on the screen, that you can point to it directly rather than indirectly, for example, using keys and pushing cursors around, which was somewhat practical in the old days where all the characters were in a straight row. With the generality of what you can put on a graphical screen, that was no longer tenable. So the mouse was picked as the pointing device. The mouse has been known since the 60s by Doug Engelbart, was probably the first who used something like a mouse for computer interaction. But the combination of the mouse with the bitmap display was the basis for this new paradigm. Xerox was the research establishment where this was developed the fullest. There were other efforts at universities, but they relied on feeble hardware that really wasn't up to the task. At Park, we lavished a lot of money, if you will, on the hardware, hoping that the prices would come down later, and really we wanted to solve the difficult problems, which we thought were the software problems. To give you an example, the manufacturing cost of an Alto was of the order of $50,000, $1972 dollars. That would be probably like $150,000 or $200,000 now. Similarly, the laser printer was about $500,000. It cost about $500,000. So very few of those were built, but you gain tremendous experience because the software is just like with my first machine, the Ural, that is completely obsolete. The software remains the same. The software ideas, rather, remain the same. We were, of course, terribly excited about the progress at Xerox and seeing, for example, Bravo and the tremendous enthusiasm of users that interacted with it. And give you an example, it was probably the first time that non-technical people started to use computers on their own. The spouses of some of the researchers were working on various projects, one that was working on a PhD thesis. Others were working on for example, newsletters for PTA. They came in at night to use the machines on their own to do that work. In the 70s, when you wrote a PhD thesis, the first thing you did was hire a typist, because you had to, of course, even if you could type, to create a clear copy without errors that was necessary for publication. That was really a job for a professional, wasn't it? This was probably the first time that real work was done on computers. Before, computer was an exclusive domain of professionals or experts. And to see these people that will be our future customers for personal computers, that was really amazing. I mean, you could see that this is going to explode. This is going to be big. At the same time, some of us, and including myself, we were unhappy in that the Xerox didn't seem to worry much or be really engaged in exploiting this tremendous potential. So at one point, I decided to look for opportunities elsewhere. And that was a time when personal computing just kind of appeared on the horizon. I remember going to a public lecture by Steve Jobs, and I was very impressed. he was describing, he was giving this talk about the fractional horsepower motor, the importance of how early factories were all driven by big motors at a central place that was distributed by shafts to the different machines in the factory. And it was the fractional horsepower motors, the small motors that could be put into the individual machines that really enabled factories to grow and really industry to prosper. And it was a very transparent metaphor for the personal computer. The personal computer would be that fractional horsepower motor that brings computing capability to everyone, rather than having the few central large computers that then are shared via difficult means and for the different tasks. So that was very interesting. And also a friend of mine who quit Xerox earlier than I did showed me an Apple II in operation with VisiCalc running. And that impressed me a lot. Visually, it wasn't much to look at, but functionally, it was something that we didn't think of at Park. And that was a shock to me, because I thought that we were not only the ways that we were ahead, but in every way. And that certainly was not true. And it kind of opened my mind to the possibility of what can be done by a feeble machine, a relatively feeble machine like the Apple II. So I went to look for a job, and it was fantastic, because Microsoft was the first company that I seriously visited. I was very impressed by the idea of software as a business, software being separated from hardware. Prior to Microsoft, you know, when you were engaged in software, your choices were between the different manufacturers. You know, you could go work for IBM, you could work for Control Data Corporation, you could work for DEC if you were very advanced. But to work for somebody who only does software, so that what attracted me to Microsoft just from the outset. You know, I didn't know any of the personalities there. And then I came and I had a great interview with Steve Ballmer and then Paul Allen, and Bill was in a meeting with customers, which was a good sign. And fortunately, he had time, and then he drove me to the airport, and we were talking all the way to the, at those times there was no security, so we could talk all the way to the door of the aircraft. So that was very exciting. I think that Bill was an incredible contrast with the managers and executives that I knew at Xerox. And in fact, I had the opportunity to look for a job within Xerox, as they knew that my project was complete, and they asked me to conduct some interviews. And so I had the fresh experience, and the contrast was just amazing. There's this 20-few-year-old kid that is full of energy, and in addition to that, the revenues are coming in, a successful business limited to computer languages and consumer products at the time, but a very nice business. But most importantly, he had an incredible vision. He knew, he understood the future much better than the so-called titans of the industry did at the time. He knew that personal computing, there would be a computer on every desk. He knew that the prices are going to come down. He knew that software was the key. He knew about graphical user interfaces and man-machine interaction. So all the components for success that I thought were necessary were there. It's really the energy and the vision. Those were the two factors that were very attractive and quite unique. At that time, it was very, very unusual and very refreshing. The long-term vision was graphical user interface, absolutely. And that is just a way of making decisions even when the graphical user interface is not around the corner. And it wasn't really possible to make bets at that early time, since the computers weren't capable of running GUI. We made the long-term decisions on the basis, on an asymptotic basis, that we are going to approach graphical user interface as it becomes available. We agreed that we are going to use C, and we are going to work on applications, and the most important application at that time was spreadsheets. So we set out to work on a spreadsheet product that was named later Multiplan. Multiplan was distinguished by an extreme degree of portability. In the early days of personal computers, there was really quite a large number of different computers that came onto the market, using different processors, using different architectures. And it was pretty exciting, and it was really a way of the market kind of shaking out what works and what doesn't work. And of course, the biggest entry was the entry of IBM with the help of Microsoft MS-DOS. But we didn't know if IBM will be, even with MS-DOS, would be as dominant as it has become. So our bet at that time was on diversity, on being able to run on as many different computers as possible. And probably Multiplan was one of the most ported applications of all time. At one point we were running on 50 different computers. These are not just different manufacturers. These are computers that are different in architectures and often even in the kind of computer chip that they were using, the machine codes that they were using. But we had a very interesting technology that enabled us to port very easily from machine to machine. Our program ran in an interpreted environment, so that was a part of the deal. We sold Multiplan, and they created the interpreter for it. Multiplan did relatively well in terms of just being a business. In areas where the machines were special, it was dominating it because there were nothing else available. It was really impossible for our competition to write spreadsheets for every kind of machine. So in many segments, it was completely dominant. Unfortunately, those segments withered away. Our other big bet, which is MS-DOS, won very big, and the IBM and compatible machines become dominant in the marketplace, which then gave rise to the emergence of Lotus 1-2-3, our biggest competitor. And Lotus 1-2-3 concentrated on exactly the opposite of what we were doing. It's looking at diversity of machines. They looked at a single machine, the most important machine, IBM PC. They just focused on one single configuration, and they created a system that was very attractive and very powerful, Lotus 1-2-3. And so they become dominant, and unfortunately, Multiplan, with its interpreted approach, couldn't compete with that. One of our eyes was crying; the other one was laughing. The MS-DOS part enjoyed the tremendous success. It was on the way of becoming a dominant operating system, and the application part was sad that our interpreted approach wasn't optimal for that particular environment. So we started by following in 1-2-3's footsteps and created a project called Odyssey, internal project that was going to take 1-2-3 head on. This never happened because in the same time scale, the Macintosh appeared on the horizon, which was a great news because finally there was one machine that could implement our dreams of graphical user interface. So we reoriented the Odyssey effort to take on a graphical shape and to run specifically on the Macintosh first. And that was the Excel project. Excel did tremendously. The group under the leadership of Jeff Harbers and Doug Lunder did the bulk of the programming, but many others participated. And they did a fantastic job and worked day and night and did this very high-quality product that really surprised people of how easy it was to use and how powerful it was at the same time, and really established Macintosh as a credible business computer, which until that point it was missing.